Good morning, colleagues. I'd like to call to order this meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education for Tuesday, February 21st. Thank you all for being here. And today we will continue our informational hearing that we started yesterday with the overview of Oregon's P20 educational system. So I don't know who comes up.
Lindsay.
Array yourselves, presenters. Yes, exactly.
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, for the record, Lindsay Capps, Chief Education Officer. Thank you for a second day of testimony for us to sort of share with you the overview. Where we left off yesterday was talking a little bit about our commitment to equity and the Oregon equity lens, and had just, I think, transitioned into talking about some of the key initiatives that we believe are important across the seamless system of education. And we want to talk a little bit this morning about the important student transition from prenatal through third grade. One of the things that we are very clear about, not only from research but experience, is the important time developmentally that our children have between ages 0 and 6, not only in their brain development, but in the way in which we are preparing them for learning. And we believe that as a state, we can lay the foundation for positive outcomes early by ensuring that our early learning system is focused on aligning comprehensive supports for children and families, and working to ensure that we have high quality and affordable childcare and preschool options for Oregon's children. We have a long way to go in serving all eligible children, which we'll talk a little bit about. But as a system in particular, I would sort of focus this subcommittee on really two areas. One is we want to make sure that fewer children start school with preventable health, developmental, and social and emotional delays. And from that perspective, we see this as a critical opportunity to link and align education and healthcare and human services in very productive ways. And that's a place where the Early Learning Division really sits at a critical intersection. Secondarily, we want to make sure that income, race, and disability-based disparities are eliminated by third grade. So that we are ensuring that all students have the best chance of academic success and graduate high school, and that's a critical benchmark in our work. And in that regard, we really see a critical opportunity for our community-based organizations, our early learning providers, and our schools working together to ensure a seamless transition between our pre-K programs and elementary grades. So I'll have David talk a little bit about the early learning programs and just express certainly from a systemic perspective and from the governor's perspective the importance of ensuring that we maintain the suite of investments in early learning as a critical foundation for our student success.
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Monroe Committee, for the record, I'm David Mandel, Acting Early Learning System Director. Just also wanted to thank Lindsay for, I think, really giving a nice setup to, and framing of the work around early learning. Today, I just wanted to cover both two of the key initiatives that have been under work for the last 2 years, and then as well to really talk about some of the work to build those strong, seamless transitions, particularly between the early learning years and elementary. The Early Learning Division and the Early Learning Council has three main goals that are the focus of all our work: children arriving at kindergarten ready to succeed, children living in healthy, stable, and attached families, and an early learning system that is coordinated, aligned, and family-centered. Over the last 2 years, there's been some significant work towards those goals. Our system of 16 regionally based early learning hubs have continued to grow and develop, and those are also the same three goals under which their work is organized. A primary focus of the hubs has been to deepen connection, the work across sectors. The hubs are statutorily charged to be working with health, human services, K through 12, traditional early learning programs, and the business sector. I'll talk about some of the work with K through 12 a bit later. Over the last 2 years, though, through close collaboration between our hubs and our coordinated care organizations, close to 30,000 children under the age of three have received a developmental screen. This means that we are able to identify developmental delays early and begin remediation early, both putting children on the path to success and reducing the costs of addressing those delays early on. And, you know, I think we also have a great opportunity with the work of those hubs to really think about how to make sure there's information sharing across Head Start programs, home visiting programs, and healthcare. It's clearly a work in progress, but I think we're really starting to see some of those pieces coming together.
Okay. Senator Monroe.
Yes. It's been my experience that tests have shown that a fairly high percentage of three-year-olds maybe have a vision problem or a hearing problem. And in the past, anyway, they just haven't been tested. So they end up in elementary grades and they're having difficulty because they can't see or they can't hear. Are we doing a good job of testing all of these little people to make sure that they're getting the support they need for dealing with the vision problems or the hearing problems?
Co-chair Monroe and Smith Warner Committee. You know, I'm not sure, to be honest, I can give you a fully comprehensive answer to that question. I mean, I think one of the real differences between the world of early learning and K through 12 is that, you know, in the world of 0 to 5, children are really in a wide variety of places, including a very high percentage, you know, at home with their parents, yeah, which is really wonderful and something that we want to support. So where we as a system connect with children at this age is, to be honest, a much more hit or miss pattern. So children who are enrolled in our Head Start and OPK programs do have those vision and hearing screenings. Whether that happens in other childcare settings, you know, is much more variegated.
Yeah, because you can tell when a kid is 1 year old if they've got a vision problem or a hearing problem, and we ought to be identifying it really early so that we can deal with it.
Okay. Representative Parrish.
Thanks. This actually just, Senator, to answer your question. I think our own pediatrician said, you know, you really can't quite get much out of a vision screening with a 2-year-old. It's kind of hard. We passed legislation, House Bill 3000, that does mandate vision screenings. We're back with a bill this session to ask for some dollars to fund it. And in the last year alone, the Lions Club's working with school districts to do, like, kindergarten kiddos, which, you know, a little older than three, but have done over 170,000 kids since we implemented House Bill 2000.
Right.
So it's happening.
Yeah.
We need to put a little dollars around it, but we're doing the work. It's great.
Okay.
And they've got thousands of kids with vision problems.
So I knew we were making progress. I just wondered where we had.
We were able to do it a little further upstream.
Yeah,
perhaps.
You bet.
Yeah,
you bet.
Okay. Representative Whitman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To follow up on Senator Monroe's comments and Representative Parrish, the bill we passed, it says when a student enters the Oregon school system, they're required to get a visual screening or visual exam. Does that include
Promise?
Do we need to amend the bill to say, you know, that counts for?
I think it's about up to age 7, before age 7,
no,
and entering the school system. There's an age.
There is. You're correct. So maybe we need to amend that bill to say.
And we have been in build. Part of Preschool Promise has been to have screenings as part of that service array. I think what I was really trying to also point out is that just for 0 to 5, those connection points with children and families are not as consistent as when they get to, you know, as when most kids are enrolled in a public school.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. the Wisnet philosophy of education is a student can't learn at entering the school door if it's hungry or if it's not healthy. And so we need to do better on that. I'd hopefully, I don't hate to say, you know, see how we're doing, Representative Parrish's comments as far as doing the testing. But I've learned enough working this bill with even Senator Monroe and Speaker Kotek many years ago that your vision changes. They need to be follow-up. Yeah. And we're not addressing the hearing at all. So those are things that we need to really focus on, hope that we can in the future. Thank you.
Well, we also passed that dental screening bill, too.
Go ahead.
Later today, you can see a bill, the one that funds this, moving towards Ways and Means. So we're going to get to have a conversation about it because it's on our bill to be worked today. We heard a hearing last week, and thank you for Representative Parrish was there and Lions Club people. But we do. The problem is there's no place except starting in kindergarten that all the kids come together, or most of the kids come together in one place. We still got homeschool and other kids that I hope their parents are following the directions that say at 1 year old you start having these regular checks to see if there's a problem, because you can find some hearing stuff in those early checkups. But kindergarten is the first time we put everybody together. So,
yeah. Go ahead, Dave.
Kutcher, Smith, Warner, Monroe, Representative Wisnet. Actually, you really touched on something that I was going to bring up later on in the presentation. I mean, I think this is always true of children and families, but I think it's even more acutely true with our youngest children, that, you know, there really is no space between early learning concerns, health concerns, basic self-sufficiency concerns. They really are quite closely integrated. And I think that's, you know, we've been, both at the Early Learning Council, that's been sort of one of the reasons for having Salam, but also Lynn Saxton from OHA and Clyde from DHS as members of the Early Learning Council, and also why the charge of the hubs has of their governance board, also including all of those sectors. I think it's, you know, it's something I'll touch on later. I think it's one of both great opportunities and great challenges to really bring those multiple needs of children and families together in a unified approach.
One of the other things. Comment on that.
Okay, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In my time in this building, I think I've seen a change from the education community too, and that I think that I see more now. The education community is saying that they have to address these too. You know, when I first came in here, I thought saw a lot of attitude that we're teachers, we're not social workers, or but you can't. Back to my theory, you can't learn if you're not healthy. So, thank you.
Go ahead.
I also wanted to touch on another initiative that's closely tied to their hubs, which is the launch of Preschool Promise just this last fall. As a result of the investment the legislature made in 2015, an additional 1,300 children are joining the 12,000 children in Head Start and OPK who have access to high-quality preschool. What Preschool Promise has enabled is the creation of preschool opportunities in a wide variety of settings of public schools, Head Start, child care, and with community-based organizations, allowing communities to adapt their own needs and resources while expanding parental choice. And I think this is just one of those, again, ongoing themes around the work in early learning, is that families really have very complex needs, desires, and interests. And I think part of what makes the work around early learning so complex is really to be recognizing that, and recognizing that there isn't just one size fits all for young families in particular.
Good morning, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. Continuing on the discussion that the committee just had relative to services that are vital for supporting students and their success, I'm going to touch on two key elements of our P3 work. And the whole notion behind our P3 is this alignment that really smooths the path for students and their families as they transition from preschool to our school system, to kindergarten in particular. Two key investments the legislature continues to support, and one that actually started in the 15th session. One is early intervention, early childhood special education. In 2015, the legislature actually appropriated an additional $9.3 million for EICSE. This additional funding sustained services to over 23,000 infants, toddlers, and preschoolers with disabilities. And even at this increase, we're not able to actually touch everyone that needs to access those services, which is vital for their learning and development and academic success. The full-day kindergarten is something we discussed yesterday. You brought it up, Co-Chair Monroe. And this is something that really levels the playing field for many students. Some districts were able to offer full-day kindergarten, but those families that were able to access those opportunities had to pay tuition, or the districts had to incur that cost themselves. So in 2015, the legislature estimated the cost for offering full-day kindergarten for all students at about $220 million, and the state school fund was adjusted to that sum in order to accommodate that increase. And from what I understand, we have over nearly 50,000 more students that attended full-day kindergarten programs in the 15-17 biennium. And as those students enroll in our system and we're able to gather data on them over the course of 3 or 4 years, we should be able to predict their performance and the effect of full-day kindergarten on their performance for being on track by third grade and continuing to experience success in our system. I would also say that this is one of our state's equity investments, because this allows all students to access full-day kindergarten. It allows them to access a full day of instruction and support that will better prepare them to be on track by third grade as they navigate our system.
So. As I mentioned earlier, a key focus of the Early Learning Hub is to build connections across sectors, including between early learning and K through 12. In addition to working with the superintendents and school districts in the regions, the hubs are required to have representation from them on their governance boards. A really important asset in this work has been the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Fund, which the legislature funded back in 2013. Through KPI, elementary schools are working directly with traditional early learning providers, creating opportunities for shared professional development between early, engaging families as equal partners in children's learning and development, and supporting successful transitions to kindergarten for children and families. Just last month, Oregon released new aligned pre-kindergarten and kindergarten early learning standards that cover approaches to learning, social-emotional development, language and communication, literacy, and early mathematics. These new early learning standards will help ensure that children have seamless learning experiences as they transition from preschool to kindergarten, and also really help with that alignment of professional development between early learning providers and kindergarten teachers. We are also really excited by the opportunities identified by the Council for Educator Advancement and laid out in SB 182 to build connections between professional development for early learning and K through 12 workforce, and see this also as an opportunity to help ensure that seamless set of educational experiences.
Here comes Iris.
So another area of interagency work is really around student readiness, engagement, and support. And this is a consistent theme that certainly builds from the early learning system into our K-12 system. And we know from study after study that our collective education agencies have a critical role to play in helping to align the system around student engagement and support to ensure that we're not only improving graduation rates, but student preparedness for the future. And we'll focus today kind of on two specific and critical areas. Part of this work is what we're doing in school in terms of improving engagement and support through relevant curriculum. We've talked about career technical education as an example of that. How we have more culturally responsive educators, how we're supporting them in that work, and ensuring that there are really positive relationships with individual students that help them remain in school. And it's also about how we build partnerships with communities. So that school and community partnership piece is critically important to address issues like chronic absenteeism, as you saw the data yesterday. The second really important piece of work are those students that are at risk of disconnecting from the system, those that we would call our priority youth, which are age 6 to 15. How we help provide specific supports for them, as well as the populations of students 16 to 24 that are opportunity youth. And these are folks that have disconnected either from the educational system or from the workforce. And it is an area where we have an opportunity to really think about a cross-sector approach between not only our K-12 system and higher ed, but frankly, with youth development as a critical link in helping us through our re-engagement strategies. There are two critical pieces of investment that this legislature put resources into. One was our Youth and Community Grant Program. The other one was our Youth and Innovation Grant Program. And for the first time in 2015, we actually put state general fund into both of those grant programs that are administered through the Youth Development Division. So I want to highlight those as a current program, but certainly want to allow Iris the opportunity to talk more specifically about the work of youth development. Maybe we'll start there, Iris. Okay.
So good morning, Chair Smith Warner, Chair Monroe. My name is Iris Bell, and I'm the director of the Youth Development Council. So thank you for having me here this morning. I was actually going to focus more on the re-engagement component of what we are doing. Our youth and community grants, as Lindsay has said, received funding for the first time, at least general fund, for the first time in the last legislative session. Most of the funds that the Youth Development Council has are federal funds. Mm-hmm. Our Title 20 Social Service Block Grant Funds is what we use basically to provide funding to and support community-based programs. So last session, we did receive some funding for the first time from the legislature so that we would have some general fund. I have said over a period of time that we really should be looking at and be somewhat concerned about the fact that most of the funds that we have come from the federal government and that the state itself needs to make a more significant investment in young people and in youth because we're actually not doing that. And with the reductions in this year's budget, we certainly aren't making that kind of investment. So I would hope that you would consider that as we move forward. With respect to youth reengagement, right now our state does not have a comprehensive reengagement plan. We have nothing that speaks to how are we going to pull back and bring back in to our school systems or to our workforce young people between the ages of 16 and 24 who are not in school and not working. And as I have spent time with most of you, you do know that that's about 59,000 young people in our state. However, there is a House bill that Representative Doherty is supporting and sponsoring. She actually submitted that as a pre-session bill, and it's right now under the process of amendment. That is House Bill 2657. And that particular bill calls for the development of a task force with some other components to it that would begin to take a look at a statewide plan on how we would definitely begin to take a look at how we bring those young people back to school or work or career. It has several components to it. One would be removing the unintended consequences of the accountability system that discourages schools and school districts from actually bringing young people back to school. Another would be allowing for the engagement system to have a regional approach so that local communities themselves could take a look at how they would approach bringing those young people back in.
Ms. Bell?
Yes.
Could you explain briefly what the current disincentive is for districts?
Representative Smith Warner, Chair Monroe. The current disincentive is that any young person who is seeking to go back into school right now would necessarily come in and not be counted towards the graduation rate. And so school districts kind of tend not to want to have their graduation rate lowered by bringing in young people who would necessarily not be on the track towards graduation. So the disincentive is that they must count those young people. In this particular bill that Representative Doherty is sponsoring, that we would be able to do away with that disincentive at the district level. Okay. So that's one of the things that
thank you.
Proposed.
I just wanted to make sure, because that really struck me when I learned that, and I just wanted to make sure that everybody on the committee was aware of that, because that just seems...
It's a, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Go ahead.
So another one of the things that it would do, what this bill would do, would be to allow for a statewide system to serve youth in multiple residences in terms of districts, because smaller rural communities have several districts. And so right now, even those students can't cross into other districts, but if you set up a process whereby those young people could go to, say, like a re-engagement center that would cross over into another district, they could still be served. And so that's another thing we're trying to do. And so we're also trying to encourage school districts and communities and technical colleges and two-year institutions to take a look at those young people who may not necessarily go back to a school district or a school, but need to move on with respect to careers, with respect to college and careers and workforce. So that's another thing that we're looking at for this particular bill. So there's a component in here where we talk about opportunities and challenges. And so the real challenge that the YDC has is to look at how do we really begin to put together a system that would allow for young people who have left school and are not working to come back. And so this is the challenge moving forward. For us.
Excuse me, Senator Roblin.
Yeah, thank you. Iris, have you looked at the possibility, because I know in our district we tried one, and that is coming up with some charter school, whether public charter schools sponsored by districts, who would look at, as part of their mission, reengaging those kids so that we support some of those efforts that are out there, knowing full well that those have the same disincentive. You got a charter school, and all of a sudden they look like they have really low graduation rates, but the reality is they've brought kids that have been out of school for 2 years. They're at least 2 years behind, but their goal and their mission is to try to help those kids be successful in the next 3 or 4 years. Have you had the opportunity to look at programs that are out there like that? Because I know some exist.
Chair Warner, Chair Monroe, yes, we have. We have been looking around the state at the various tools and mechanisms that communities are using to bring their young people back, and alternative schools is indeed one of the ways in which young people are finding their way back to education and or career, for sure.
Hold on.
Go ahead, Senator.
So one of the other disincentives is that your programs now go from 16 to 24.
That's right.
And school districts have a requirement to 21. Are there school districts that are looking at opportunities to try to figure out how to work with that other group of students that maybe don't feel like they're ready for community college or other kinds of things, but in that 21 to 24 group that allow them to get reengaged in schools?
I'm not aware directly of any of those districts that are doing that. I am aware that on the workforce side, there are some workforce efforts that are taking place with respect to these young people who would not only bring them back into the workforce, but also allow for some education and training of those young people. And so that workforce component, and that's another one of the areas that we have been looking at, is our workforce and our workforce grant. We have a youth and workforce grant as well. And so there is where we're seeing young people, and we're trying to take a look at how the local workforce boards could actually connect and align with them. And another thing about these young people is, you know, they can walk into some of the workforce, work source buildings that you see around the state, but they're still pretty much young people. And so we were looking at the fact that perhaps within the context of those work source buildings, there could be folks identified to specifically deal with this population, this young population, because they're basically seen as adults, but they don't have all the tools and the skills to navigate through those systems as adults. And so, again, another way in which to bridge that gap is to do that with our workforce.
Senator Roman?
Thank you, and this will be my last one for this time. The other issue is that community colleges, we are looking at higher ed, and we'll ask them this question later. They have some disincentives now working into their system because they're asking for cohorts to graduate on time, and that's becoming a part of what HEC is looking at. And so are they going to be shying away from these work investment kinds of programs with kids, knowing that those kids have some extra time, they may affect them with regard to their progress being made towards goals of graduation? So I hope we're looking at that as in yours, and we'll talk to them when they come there, but especially with respect to, because you carry over all of these programs. I mean, this board, your Oregon Youth Development Board, crosses all of the programs that we have, other than early childhood. You haven't got there yet, except a number of your clients have early childhood kids with them.
Right.
Anyway, I just want to make sure we watch that as we put in new incentives to get more graduation at college and all the other kind of stuff. These students get hurt by every time we do that.
Every time.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Bell, can you explain, you went to 24 because the federal government had complied with a federal government requirement, correct? Would you comment on that?
Well, it was a combination of the federal government requirement, but also because the local workforce boards, with the ones that were serving some of the youth, also went to 24, and they also adopted the opportunity youth component. 75% of the funding for all local workforce boards for youth now must be for opportunity youth, and opportunity youth are the 16 to 24-year-olds.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Just, a comment to you and CEO Caps that, I mean, the age group you used to work with up to 19 is a very interesting group and very demanding and very troubling group that we sometimes overlook as a parent and as a grandparent. I worry about that age group tremendously. And now we've gone up to 24. We're giving insurance up to 26 with a family. School districts have to go to 21. I love my son, but sometime we got to kick them out of the nest. I don't understand how, and then the the cost of this and everything. It's a challenge. I don't know how you're gonna. I mean, it's gonna be unbelievable. And wish you luck. I'll try to support it.
It is.
Representative Parrish.
Thanks. My question is sort of around like the other issues going on with kids in this population, because it's not just a pathway to a job or a pathway to back into school.
Right.
I mean, it's housing. It is healthcare. I've raised up other people's children who fall into this category, and it's hard.
Absolutely.
To get them moving in the right direction. Mm-hmm. We just finally got one off into basic training this month, and he's 24. And it took a long time to get him there. And he didn't graduate high school. And it took a while to get the GED and, get him on the right path. And so what's your agency doing to look at some of those other sort of parallel issues that are keeping kids from, being successful? There's reasons people fall out of.
Right.
And if you don't get them back on that path, it's just going to cost society a lot of money later on.
Co-Chair Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Parrish, you're absolutely correct. And what the council has done is looked at what we call barriers to learning. And as a result of that, we put out a document that kind of looks at what those barriers might be. And those barriers kind of run the whole spectrum from what's happening in community and neighborhood, what's happening with respect to health and mental health issues, what's happening with respect to things like homelessness, children who are in our child welfare system, our foster youth. And so, yes, those barriers definitely get in the way. And what we have done and what we are basically charged with doing is looking at the alignment and continuity of services across the various state agencies and saying to them, how are you impacting the lives of these young people across this system, not necessarily within a siloed approach, but with a comprehensive approach. And so that's one of the things that we have been really speaking to and really attempting to try and address by calling to the attention. And we did this with respect to the policy briefs. I'm sure all of you got those. The policy briefs that sort of call to the attention of some of our state agencies, some of the needs of these young people, and then the kinds of recommendations that we're making for this sort of coordination of services and resources to those young people.
Go ahead.
So to Senator Roblin's point about, like, are you looking for education models, and particularly for kids that still kind of qualify in that K-12 dollar, there are folks back east that are doing public boarding options where they use K-12 dollars on the day side, they use housing dollars and foster care dollars for the residential side, and those kiddos qualify for what would be a CCO here, and they use those dollars to put in health care. I mean, it seems to me if you've got kids who are 16 and homeless and need a place to go, and they're out of school, and they're not working, and they're not connecting with mom and dad, that part of having an option isn't just on the day side of can we get you into school?
Right.
There's sort of this
right.
other piece that I think has to go in. Now we've got to build a, try to evaluate that and look at that as an option for Oregon, hoping it gets a hearing. But are you looking at right. things that are sort of out of the box like that
yes,
as well?
Yes, actually we are looking at those sorts of things, and we're looking at them basically at the community level. So we don't have a statewide sort of look or lens on that. But if you take a look at what communities are doing, they're doing just that. They're pulling together their resource around homeless dollars, and they're pulling together their resource around foster care dollars, and they're coming together and helping to support those young people really at a very grassroots, community-based level. And what we try to do is to support those community efforts and to support those kinds of organizations around this state who are doing phenomenal things with very little money to try and pull together and create those very kinds of systems that you're talking about. But it's done, again, in community. It's not that we have a statewide lens on that approach.
I'd like to see us get a statewide lens. I don't think you can. Philanthropy only goes so far.
Yeah.
And I appreciate the folks that, you know, put their money into kids, but if we don't put our own investment into that, then those types of programs, I've watched them even in the last 6 years just come and go, come and go, come and go, you know, based on a donor's interest. And if that interest goes away, that program goes away.
Mm-hmm.
So
I agree.
I'm very hopeful that we can engage in that conversation, that the governor's office will engage in that conversation, because, you know, a lot of these kids are coming out of our foster care system, which is
right.
horribly broken. And, you know, we've got kids homeless on the Springwater Trail. I mean, some of this stuff is as a mother, it is absolutely makes me want to tear my hair out. But having grown up that way, I also know what those kids are going through.
That's
and
right.
we have got to do something differently. So I appreciate your work.
Thank
try
you.
To be engaged in
Thank
that.
You.
So, colleagues, I know Rep. Hernandez has a question, but we do want to get through the rest of the overview today. And all of these folks will be back for the next multiple long weeks. So we want to get through the high-level overview today. Go ahead, Rep. Hernandez.
I'll be really quick and offer more of my own experience with the council itself. I started a nonprofit 5 years ago that particularly dedicates its time to these young folks, those that drop out or don't meet the graduation requirements and are at the margins of our society, particularly those from marginalized and underrepresented communities, from the LGBTQ mm-hmm. community, from communities of color, and young people with disabilities. And so I think my organization has engaged with the council, and I know that it's just recently received general funds, and I've seen the work that it's done in terms of its community outreach and its ability to build relationships with grassroots community-based organizations. And I think that's the pathway.
Absolutely.
Because those on the ground know the solutions. They just need that larger framework and resources to do the work. So I want to appreciate that we're headed towards that direction. And hopefully we also figure out a way to engage homeless and LGBTQ folks, and maybe you want to briefly mention what the council is working on in that area, respect.
Representative Hernandez, actually, as you see the list of policies and investments for 2017-19, there are two that are actually missing that the council is sponsoring, or at least one coming from the governor's office, and that's House Bill 2261, which is a bill to look at statewide coordination for LGBTQ youth. And so I would ask you to put that on your radar as we move forward. Another, and additionally, is in House Bill 2657. So those two would be the two policy investment bills from the YDC that we would really like you to keep your eyes on.
Thank you.
So we'll transition a little bit to talk about current programs around chronic absenteeism, and I'll turn it over to Salam to talk a little bit about the work through the department.
Thank you, Lindsay. I think chronic absenteeism is a theme that you've heard throughout our presentation. And I think it's fair to say that we as a state have a significant issue with chronic absenteeism. In fact, in 2015-16, nearly 102,000 students in Oregon which is more than one in six, were chronically absent from school. And we all know and understand the consequences of not being in school. If students are not schooled, they're not engaged, they're not in learning, they're falling behind in their learning, they're falling behind in their credits, they lose their incentives to come to school and stay in school, and unfortunately at times they end up dropping out. So it is definitely a downward spiral. And to that end, the state has actually worked with the coordination and the leadership of Lindsay and the Chief Ed Office, bringing our agencies together to develop a statewide chronic absenteeism plan to combat chronic absenteeism. And we submitted that plan to the legislature. It was actually required through a bill. And we're pretty excited, actually, about the elements that are contained in that plan, because they provide a systemic approach to define chronic absenteeism, so we're all clear about what that actually means. And we're consistent in identifying and tracking the effects of chronic absenteeism, and also to take some proactive steps to identify the students that are likely to be absent and try and mitigate the reasons and the conditions that are contributing to that, in consistent with the discussion that we just had. The plan also provides recommendations in terms of best practices, replicating effective and best practices, identifying strategies in the form of coaching and mentoring and other supports to students, and also working with the adults to provide professional development to our educators to help them recognize the symptoms, recognize the pattern, if you will, and to provide interventions that are both instructional in nature and social, emotional, and developmental in nature as well for our students. One example of our work on chronic absenteeism is our tribal attendance pilot project, and I shared with you some information about that yesterday. This project is really enormous because we see this tendency greatly in our Native American students. And there are many factors that contribute to their absenteeism from school. So the project is working with our nine confederated tribes, with the school districts that students attend, and we're seeing tremendous change, not only in the students, but in their families and the community in which they live. We're seeing exponential increases in attendance. The data is early. This is our first year of implementation. But I think we're seeing high level of engagement by the staff, high level of engagement by the families and the parents in particular, and students are in school. And as I shared with you yesterday, we're seeing dramatic changes from 50% attendance in fourth and fifth graders to 95 and 97, increases from 75% to 95 and 98 in some instances. And these are real life students. We met with those folks last week, and they shared with us real life examples, and wish I had the pictures with me to show you the kids. These are the kids that are themselves sharing with us and saying, I improved my attendance. My family now understands the importance of being in school. The community now understands the importance for me to be in school, and they're putting pressure on me to stay in school. So it's created a heightened sense of relevance and engagement for the families and the students. So, and we'll be happy to share more with you about this in our presentations next week.
Madam Chair, just as a side note, I believe the report that Salam was referring to is under your materials from yesterday,
yes.
Along with a report on educator professional development, or whatever it's called, that will be coming up a little later this morning in the presentation.
Okay. So part of the work around chronic absenteeism really layers into our overall focus around high school graduation outcomes. And I think what I'll do is go ahead and just move ahead to the next area of focus from an interagency perspective. In the creation of an education innovation officer position within the Chief Education Office, the governor was really looking to put a spotlight on how we can best replicate strategies across schools and communities to improve graduation outcomes, with the appointment of Colt Gill to this position, creating a collaborative opportunity between him, the Chief Education Office, and ODE to be really thinking about that linkage between regional and community-based program strategies and practices that are making a difference, and state-level policy. And so a part of the outcome of that work has really been proposal that we have before the legislature, Senate Bill 183, the Graduation Equity Fund, which contains a piece around attendance, but also a couple of other strategies that we think are particularly important from a system perspective to improve graduation outcomes. And so, turn it over to you, Colt.
Co-Chair Smith Warner and Monroe, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Colt Gill, Education Innovation Officer for Oregon and the Chief Education Office. I'm going to share a little bit about the current initiatives under the under my position, and I'm going to leave some holes in my discussion because we're working closely with the Department of Education and Deputy Superintendent Knorr on our engagement efforts and on the development of Senate Bill 183. So I'll share some things and then I'll pass this off back to Deputy Superintendent to fill in some of those spaces where ODE is doing the work. So Lindsay shared yesterday that our efforts are designed around working alongside communities and local school systems to reach educational equity and eradicate opportunities and achievement gaps. Deputy Superintendent and I have formed an interagency graduation improvement team that includes members from ODE, the Chief Education Office, the Early Learning Division, the Youth Development Division, and the HEC to take education research as well as data that we both collected through engagement with students, families, educators, business leaders, and community partners. Salam did this through his graduation advisory committee and through a blueprint design team, as well as his ESSA meetings that happened across the state of Oregon. He'll touch on those in just a minute. I'm going to move forward a little bit here. I did this through a series of visits across our state. Oregon's communities are very diverse. We need local perspectives to tackle our statewide graduation dilemma. So we traveled to our communities. This summer and fall, I was able to hear from over 1,000 people representing dozens of communities across 32 of our counties. Participants across the state were welcoming, open, and willing to share local and sometimes very personal stories, challenges to supporting students on their path to graduation. These meetings were full of passion and celebration and sometimes tears. Special care was taken to meet with members of historically underrepresented groups in these visits, LGBTQ, tribal members, students of color, families navigating poverty, all to ensure that most voices were heard. We compiled the input and categorized it in a few ways in a report. I think that's also in your materials. We learned that across our state, there was a common need for focus on equitable practices and outcomes and for the development of strong relationships, partnerships, and relevance for our students. With these in place, we could implement a number of strategies to prepare, support, and engage our students and families. In Oregon in particular, part of our challenge is also to identify economical, high-leverage investments that align with what local students, parents, educators, and community members tell us their children need to succeed. So I'm going to let Salam share a little bit about their outreach, and then we'll share a little bit more about Senate Bill 183 and the High School Graduation and Career and College Readiness Act.
Thank you, Colt. In the interest of time, I will be really brief and not get into a lot of the community conversations that we've had. We've held 20 community forums around the Every Student Succeeds Act. What I will share with the committee is that the themes that Colt just described are consistent in every venue that we've engaged, whether it's with parents, students, community members at large, educators. Those are the themes that we hear: engagement, the appropriate supports and interventions for students, a well-rounded education. Equity is a key component of identifying students that need those additional supports and interventions, and applying preventions and not just interventions. So one of the key outcomes of our engagement, and Cole touched on it, is our High School Graduation Advisory Committee. And this committee is comprised of practitioners. And this is another thing that I would emphasize, is that our work is really nested in practitioners' input, voices, perspectives. So the graduation graduation advisory committee has principals, teachers, partners from community-based organizations that are actually doing this work with schools and teachers on the ground. And they informed our work about the specific strategies that will help improve graduation outcomes for students. And those are school-based and community-based strategies. So the blueprint, as we refer to it, is really a framework that brings together eight key elements that are proven to have a positive effect on graduation, and they're not limited to high school. They are actually, they apply to middle school, elementary, and preschool programs, as if you will.
Excuse me, Swan.
Yes.
Just to make sure I'm tracking this correctly. So the High School Graduation Advisory Committee already exists. It is not something that is part of Senate Bill 183.
That is, Co-Chair Smith Warner, that is correct.
Okay.
Yep. Yep. It's, we want it to be proactive, and we want it to look at practice. Okay. So instead of creating frameworks based on theory and just based on literature, if you will, we gathered some of the best practitioners in our state, meaning principals, superintendents, and teachers, and community partners like Self-Enhancement Inc., if you, the Self-Enhancement Inc., if you will, to help us from their perspective identify effective strategies. Then we compared those strategies to research. And Colt did the same thing with his community conversations around the state. We developed something that he can probably talk about. It's called the synthesis. And it has specific research-proven strategies that help improve graduation outcome.
Okay.
But this committee is an advisory committee to us. We go to them to vet ideas, to vet research. We rely on them to help inform our policy work and our practice. And we also use them to help share with other schools and districts around the state what actually works.
Great.
And
thank
we've captured their work in what we call a graduation brief that highlights practices in specific schools around the state, both rural and urban.
Great. And are there any members of the Youth Development Council, of the council itself, on that?
Yes, there are.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think I'll stop here and turn it back to
okay.
you, Colin.
Senate Bill 183. So the Graduation Equity Fund, Senate Bill 183, was born from a combination of reviewing successful efforts in other states and this engagement with communities across Oregon that we've talked about. So Senate Bill 183 aims to implement three initiatives across the state in a way that allows schools and communities to tap into a promising practice and resource, but implement with local flexibility. The first of those three is the Early Indicator and Intervention System, which are used by close to 30 other states. Many of these states and districts that have these in place have seen year after year graduation rate increases of 2 to 4%. They attribute those gains to these systems. Our schools in Oregon use data, but this is using data in new ways. It's called predictive analytics, and it works in a similar way to the way that Amazon or Netflix has the ability to predict what you may be interested in purchasing next. So it goes beyond state test scores. It looks at a student's attendance, behavior, and academic performance in classes. And then it applies a longitudinal data and research to predict whether the student's current data shows them to be on track for graduation or falling behind. And this allows educators, students, and families to work together to intervene and support students before they're too far down a path that's causing them to be at risk for failing to graduate. Next are trauma-informed practices, which help students who have endured adverse experiences like a death in the family or hunger, or children who are part of a marginalized group in Oregon. Trauma-informed practices alter the way that staff interact with students and help these students feel that they are welcome and fully included in the school community. It also helps them build resiliency skills that can help them reach graduation and achieve their goals after graduation. Finally, chronic absenteeism is also a piece of Senate Bill 183. Chronic absenteeism has a clear connection with reduced graduation rates. The statewide plan for addressing chronic absenteeism that we talked about earlier has a focus on building positive relationships between schools and families and communities, based much on the tribal experience that Deputy Superintendent Noor talked about. It also discusses providing engaging curriculum, implementing culturally responsive and sustaining practices, and developing partnerships between schools and community organizations that provide holistic supports to students and families. I think the only thing I'll add around the High School Graduation, College and Career Readiness Act is that we're also using this same engagement strategy to connect with local providers and communities around a successful implementation of the act to ensure that it meets its goals. For the last several weeks, we've been working on this engagement. ODE has also been working on the High School Graduation, College and Career Readiness Act. By statute, they are to develop rules that the State Board will consider and actually adopt later this week.
Mm-hmm.
Separate to that, I've been facilitating an interagency team that was put together by Lindsay Capps, Salam Noor, and Ben Cannon. Specifically, this team was formed to collect stakeholder impact for two reasons. One is that Governor Brown signaled her support for the act by designating $141 million in new CTE formula funding in her recommended budget, and second, to ensure that implementation of the act results in improved graduation outcomes. So we've got together with a number of stakeholders to review different pieces of the act and consider policy that may need to be addressed to ensure its success.
The only thing that I would add is that the rules by law are required to be adopted by March 1st. So the board, as Colt indicated, will adopt rules by Thursday. And those rules can be amended based on future legislative action. So we are prepared to do that in an expedient manner once the legislature takes action, should you choose to take action relative to the law. But we are following the law, and that's why the rules are being adopted by March 1st.
So our next area of focus is around related to the Measure 98 conversation we just had around career-connected learning, and we certainly see the opportunities to expand our system in supporting access to both career technical education and STEAM education programs across the state. Last legislative session, you all were responsible for doubling our state's investment in both CTE and STEAM. Certainly, with the High School and College and Career Readiness Act, that will exponentially increase potentially the support for this work in our schools and certainly into our higher education system. I want to focus just briefly on our current initiatives relative to CTE and STEM, and recognize the existing access that and participation that we see across the state, with about 48,259 students currently participating in a CTE program. But we know that we are not reaching all parts of the state, and certainly do not have career pathways necessarily established either within our secondary level schools or in the transition to higher education. We've also established STEM hubs across the state as a means of helping to connect not only educators in training around STEM fields, whether that be in engineering, math, or science or technology, but certainly in building partnerships between business and industry and education to help support those learning opportunities. So that's a piece of work that we'll continue to talk with you a little bit about, certainly in the context of Measure 98. But I want to give the opportunity for both Salam and Ben to talk a little bit about the opportunities both in the K-12 and higher ed system.
Yeah. Thank you, Lindsay. Career and technical education programs, as we all have discussed with you, really lead to student engagement, student motivation to be in school. But most importantly, they really show the connection for students between what they're learning in school and a potential career pathway. Some of their dreams and aspirations can actually become real when students participate in a career and technical education program, or a course for that matter. And in some cases, it really shows the student what they're interested in, and in others what they're not interested in. So we have a large number of students that participate in CTE programs. We have about 48,000 that participate in what's called a program of study. And a program of study is a sequence of courses in high school that are articulated with a community college program. So it could be in manufacturing, in architecture, in engineering, in construction, in health, nursing. So students take 3 or 4 courses in high school, and those courses translate to credits in college, and it puts them on a path to continue their education to receive certification. Half of those students participate in CTE programs where they want to just experience different programs and different career paths and options that are available to them. What I will tell you, based on our state's investment, especially in the CTE area, in the form of the CTE revitalization grants that provided grants to communities around the state that in the past were not able to support career and technical education, they have really transformed schools. So the CTE revitalization grant that Baker High School received, for example, led to the creation of the Baker Technical Institute. And students engage in really high advanced specific career and technical education training every day at that school in a variety of programs. What's exciting is that also provided a venue for community members to come in and participate in career and technical education opportunities. And in some instances, it's just exploration. In fact, at Baker Technical Institute, they have a class that's called Welding for Women. So there are 9 ladies that come in, and they learn to weld in the evenings. And it's generating some community enthusiasm and excitement. And who knows, those 9 ladies may decide to go to the community college and pursue a welding certificate and become welders. In Redmond, it's the same thing. If you visit their career and technical education programs, what they always talk about is the CTE revitalization grant that helped seed those programs and generated some additional revenue and funding from community partners to expand them. So the opportunities have really expanded exponentially, I would say, as a result of these small investments. And it provides communities, rural communities in particular, that can't afford would never dream of developing a nursing program, if you will, to seed that program and sustain it over time. The same is true with our STEM work. It's providing students exposure to a variety of career pathways and options in the engineering and the technology field. It's connecting math and science into these fields. And most importantly is the support that teachers are receiving from our STEM hubs for professional development, professional learning, and connecting them with business and employers to provide access to career-related learning opportunities for students, but also opportunities for teachers to expand their knowledge and experience and understanding of the field that they are working in. So,
can I?
Senator Roblin.
Thank you. So CTE is a particular program, and I think a lot of people don't understand necessarily. So if you're going to get Carl Perkins money, you've got to have an approved program. So when we're talking about the 48,000 kids, is that kids that are involved specifically in a program of study, which means more than one class? Or is it all the kids that have taken a course that's listed as part of the CTE programming that a school district may have?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner and Monroe and Senator Roblin, thank you for the question. That's really an important clarification. So 48,000 were participated in CTE, and that could be a single course or a sequence of courses. Half of those, about 21,000, I would say, were in an approved program of study.
Okay.
And it's an important distinction. You're absolutely right.
Follow up.
Senator Roman, go ahead.
So the kids that we hear when we say they graduated at a higher rate, they go on to community college or wherever they're going to go, those are the kids that are registered in the program more than the ones that are just taking an individual class, right? So sometimes we forget that when we're talking about the group and we think, oh, they took a class, so they're going to have a better graduation rate. The reality is the group that we study and predict about are those that are in a prescribed program. Is that not true?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner and Monroe, Senator Roblin, the answer is yes, but if I may qualify it slightly.
Please.
Because you're absolutely right. We throw these numbers out and say if you take one course, you're going to have a 95-plus graduation rate. Where in actuality, it's the concentrators. So the definition is a concentrator, and it's a student that has taken 2 or more courses of CTE, and they tend to be the ones that are in a program of study.
Right.
But it doesn't necessarily preclude the others, but
right.
we tend to track the ones that have participated in two or more credits in a program of study.
And in fact, we do have, school districts are required, if they have those programs, to keep numbers of kids that actually completed the program. Do we have statistics on how many of this 48,000 kids actually complete a program of study and move on? Because I think it's important for us to really understand. School districts have to make a big commitment if they're going to have a CTE program.
Right.
It's different
mm-hmm.
from STEM and all these other things that are talking about courses and here and there. Is that?
Yep. Co-Chair Smith, Warner, Monroe, and Senator Roblin, that is correct. And I believe we can get this data because okay. we collect it on concentrators.
Right.
It will be primarily those that participate in the Perkins-funded programs. But
right.
as we expand our CTE, we're trying to apply that across the board. And I believe we can track those students at the community college level based on the secure student ID number. Right, Ben?
Yep.
So, okay.
Thank you.
In the interest of Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director, Oregon Higher Education Committee, and just in the interest of time, I'll be very brief on this point. The committee well knows the centrality of career and technical education in Oregon higher education, particularly at the community college level, where our 17 institutions have a longstanding commitment to putting career-related learning at the center of their institutional missions, serving not only young people, which have been the I think the emphasis of sort of growing emphasis on CTE, but also adults of all ages. I think what's particularly new and exciting in this realm are some of the links to high school, the development of better articulated career pathways for students beginning at the high school level, but with really very clear and sort of stackable development opportunities from high school into a community college or other higher education institution, and we look forward to continuing that work and reporting on its success to this committee later in this session and in subsequent years.
Senator Roblin.
And thank you, Madam Chair. This is a Ben question. It kind of goes along with what I was talking about with IRIS. Are we, as we develop criteria for community colleges and others to show their success through mm-hmm. programs, are we including conversations about the number of kids that enrolled in and then finished GEDs, the number of kids who came in and finished a program of study to get a certificate or whatever, and not just working towards a graduation from the college and getting an associate's degree or whatever?
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, yes. I think the key point is that a community college mission cannot be boiled down to a single degree
okay.
or certificate type. It serves, community colleges serve many different types of learners coming to colleges for very different types of reasons. And as a result, when we present, for example, on the graduation rate for community colleges, we struggle to do so in a way that feels authentic to and consistent with the breadth of learners and breadth of mission that a community college has, because the graduation rate, as it's defined, for example, by the federal government, takes such a narrow view of what constitutes success. That said, I do want to emphasize, it is particularly for those students, so, including many of the types that Director Bell's agency division serves, that success at the community college is so very important, right? When we're talking about students, particularly students who are incurring tuition costs, taking on loans, in many cases significant loans to attend community college, it is precisely for those students whom we have to be most attentive to completion and success. So I think your caution is appropriate relative to ensuring we don't have a narrow definition, too narrow a definition of what success or completion is, but we should not back away from the sort of criticality of ensuring that we are providing success so they're not, you know, leaving with debt and no certificate, degree, or other marker of success.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you. And this is one that I always bring up just because it's a pet peeve of mine that we as a legislature made a decision on how we fund community colleges. And that changed community colleges from being community colleges, in my opinion, because we used to see their role in a community as involving everyone, including our senior citizens and other people. And we used to actually pay we gave money, basically, based on a whole bunch of these other courses that enriched communities. And when we stopped doing that, the legislature, we actually watched the demise of the local community colleges, in the sense that for years, there was never a bond that a community college put up that didn't pass, because all of the people in the community went to the community college, and they all understood the importance to them. Now it's mostly just those people in degree programs, and so we have lost a group of people who used to spend a lot of time on our campuses, who were vital parts of that whole community, and they are not there as often, and they are not supporting the same way that they used to. And I hope that, you know, it's led to us taking over half of the cost of buildings and other stuff, which we never did for community colleges. We didn't need to. And I hope we have that conversation in HEC over time about what do we really want these community colleges to invest in, and how are we going to spend the money? Because if you want to figure out how things work, follow the money. And when you follow that money go away, you watched, in my opinion, community colleges losing some of the impetus that they had in our community. So I bring it up each year. So thanks.
Yes, I've heard it before. Yeah, I agree.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair?
Yes. Senator Monroe.
And while he's singing this same song, I've got mine, and that is that state funding to community college programs is based on a per class and does not differentiate between, you know, regular kinds of programs and the more expensive career-oriented programs, medical or whatever it be. And as a result, many community colleges are turned students away from those more expensive programs because they have to fund them exclusively with their own money, and they don't have it. So your issue I agree with. I think my issue is valid as well.
Real quick, I just want to acknowledge that the reason the community colleges in the past were able to do more of that is that for some of those other community courses, they shifted the value of that money to those programs. And I agree 100% with
that. Duly noted. Let's try to get through the high school to post-secondary student transitions in the next 5 minutes, okay. And then we will start tomorrow morning with educator workforce.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So the next area of interagency collaboration is high school to post-secondary student transitions, and we'll be very brief because I know there'll be further conversation as respective agencies come forward to talk about this. And we'll talk really about two areas. The first is really how we're supporting the transition from high school to post-secondary in two ways. One is through Regional Promise grants that we established to create cross-sector partnerships between our K-12 school districts, ESDs, and our community colleges to provide college-level coursework in high school. We know from research that has a huge benefit when underserved students have access to college credit, that oftentimes leads to those students going on to college. So this is an area of investment that we're interested in continuing. We're also, as agencies, myself, the deputy superintendent, and Mr. Cannon have actually pulled together a visioning group that is going to be coming together in March, inclusive of superintendents and college community college presidents, to have further conversation about how we move beyond sort of a piloted approach around Regional Promise to a more systemic effort to try to create partnerships between K-12 and our post-secondary institutions to make college credit accelerated learning options more available. The second area of work has been around the Senate Bill 214 work group recommendations, which were that process was led by the HEC executive director. We've had the opportunity to put in place a collaboration between secondary level counselors and post-secondary counselors to think about transitional supports, most especially through the Oregon Promise. We had a great summit in Bend. Representative Wisnett was there, bringing those folks together to think about that work. So more that we can report on that collaboration, but I'll allow Ben and Salam to offer any comments further about that.
Very little to add. Lindsay covered it well. Just noting this summer summit, which was one of nearly a dozen different activities funded through that Senate Bill 418 work, but that summer summit brought 360 individuals from high schools, colleges, universities, really in the advising, counseling space, many of whom had not connected on a regional basis before. There's been a lot that's followed from that we've helped to support to ensure that really high school counselors and advisors are talking to their college counterparts. Just one data point, not directly related to that summer, but summit, but I think in this space and related to some other work that the legislature has helped to support, Oregon saw the nation's largest increase last year in the percentage of high school seniors who completed their FAFSAs, their applications for federal financial aid. So whereas the country as a whole was stagnant, even down a little among the high school senior population, we saw nearly a 10% increase in the percent of Oregonians who completed a FAFSA. And there's a lot that went into that. Oregon Promise played a part in other initiatives. But we do think we're strengthening the kind of advice and support that we're providing to high school students in an effort to help them access college and career.
Representative Parrish.
Thanks. On the transitions piece, are you talking at all about, because I think it's a transition issue, when you've got kids who are coming out of our high schools and they go into our community colleges and they're having to take on debt to be remediated. So are you addressing that at all in these discussions? Because if you've got a kiddo who's got to take, you know, 2-3 terms to get caught up and things we should have taught them in K-12, and they're taking on that debt, and that is a transition problem. And I've talked to students who are like, this is more work than I want to do. I'm not going to, you know, I'm just going to leave from this. I've incurred debt. They took out student loans already for, you know, community college that they didn't finish. And that is something I am hearing in my communities, is that, you know, the high cost of remediation for those students, and they have to take on that debt when we spent, you know, arguably $130,000 over their K-12 lifespan, and they get to community colleges and they can't even get through that entrance exam to do the placement, is a transition problem in my mind.
Representative Parrish, co-chairs, members of the committee, it's a very important issue, a very important point. Nearly 70% of our, more than 70% of our direct from high school students into community college find that they are not placing into college level math or language arts. And I'll just touch on a couple of things that we're doing, and Salam may have others to add. One is the issue of alignment. So this is not perhaps the primary cause of the problem, but it is a contributor to the problem. So take, for example, math, where the expectations for what a high school graduate should be able to do in math don't perfectly match the expectations of what the community college, when it examines that student, expects them to know in order to enter college-level math. And so in partnership with the Department of Education and the State Board of Ed, we are taking on or attempting to take on that issue of better aligning the standards and expectations between K-12 and our higher education partners. The other piece within higher education that is, I think, very much within the control of our community colleges is the practice of developmental education itself, because frankly, we've struggled, number one, to appropriately assess students for developmental education, but we've likewise struggled to effectively move students through developmental education or provide developmental education in a way that that gives students a college credit bearing experience at the same time. And so with state support and state investment, our 17 community colleges are reforming their practice of developmental education. In some cases, it means not actually putting the student in developmental ed or using using extra supports for students who were did not pass the exam, putting them in the college level class anyway, but providing extra wraparound sort of supports in small group settings so that they're earning college credit, but they're getting the support they need in order to get through that course. It's taking different approaches at different colleges, but a lot of work in that vein by the colleges themselves.
Yeah.
I think Ben touched on it really well, and especially the alignment piece. And in some instances, it's really not the alignment of what students are learning in high school and what they will be learning in college. It's the misalignment with the assessment tool that we're using. So students are learning to the standards that we have in the K-12 system, but the Praxis test or another test at the post-secondary level is not measuring the same standards and the same knowledge that they've been exposed to. So we do have a misalignment in the assessment and in some instances in the standards that students are learning and whether they align to the post-secondary system's expectations. One of the other solutions that we considered, and it's related to counseling, is providing information to students early on relative to college's expectation, providing information to teachers about what colleges actually expect, exposing the issue of remediation early on in high school so students and their families understand the potential cost for remediation if students don't actively engage and teachers don't actively engage in providing the appropriate instruction. The Regional Promise grants, if you will, also provided some innovative practices where college faculty come together with high school faculty to look at student work and started developing alternative ways of measuring student proficiency, so we're not relying exclusively on the entrance exam that a student would take at a community college or a university. So there are lots of ways that are being considered right now to help address this issue, but ultimately we need to have a seamless pathway between our K-12 system and our post-secondary system. Thank you.
The real quick follow-up is that, I mean, I'm hopeful as you try to solve that misalignment issue, that the goal is to bring the standard in K-12 up to match the community college rather than bring the community college standard down, because it still doesn't deal with the issue of what it takes to get a bachelor's degree and have to do that remediation piece. And then the other piece that I hope that the governor's considering is the cost side. I think it's just morally reprehensible that kids are taking on debt to be remediated for things they should have learned in K-12 and being saddled with a lifelong student loan debt for a program they may or may not graduate from.
Yep.
I just want to say that I really am excited to hear the conversation is happening in the sense that I had a number of students who went on to four-year universities, didn't take an entrance exam, took their transcripts, went into calculus, did fine, came back to take a class at a community college. They told him he had to have an exam. He took the exam. They said he had to take a remedial class. He'd already gotten an A at the university in his calculus class. He didn't understand why he needed to take remediation. We tried multiple times to get the entrance exams from the community college, and we got the one from our community college to give to our 11th graders so they could actually see what they needed to know, because we were trying to align. It is exceedingly frustrating for school districts and others to go through this constantly with kids that we know are going to be successful, and yet the different kinds of exams. And when you know we have multiple community colleges, they have multiple exams. That's getting better, but they had multiple exams for entry exams. It really was hard for a high school person to try to meet all those requirements, and it was easier to say, go to a four-year school, because they're not going to give you an exam necessarily, and they'll just keep you going. And in community colleges, they made them take all these tests when they had been successful in high school and were never given a chance to start in the regular course. So I think we need to be careful when we make judgments about, because they've taken all these tests and they're 75% have to be remediated, much better to have a one-week course at the beginning of the semester that says, if you didn't do well in this test, here's your brush-up on math, which you haven't had for a year, and now you can handle the math class. So I'm happy you're doing what you're doing, and I hope we continue to do it. Thank you. Sorry.
Yes.
Okay. Let's see how you do, Ben.
Madam Co-Chair,
members of the committee. Two very small programs.
Yes.
We will.
But I'm sure we don't have any questions about
accessibility and affordability. This slide previews really what will be an in-depth discussion of these programs and other HEC initiatives related to accessible and affordable higher education. You see the high-level details there in the bill that I think it's on its way to this subcommittee for consideration related to the Oregon Promise in this current year, and I'm sure we'll be talking about its ongoing future for 2017-19 as well. Thank you.
Good job.
Great.
That was impressive.
Thank you.
Impressive.
Colleagues, we are going to carry over the remainder of this informational hearing until tomorrow, Wednesday, February 22nd. And anything else? There's not anything else? We are adjourned. Thank you. We are adjourned. Thank you.